Once more under the breach, dear friends.
Else close the wall up with our English stead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
Well, you sounded like a glee club there for a moment.
I thought that glee, that's good. I mean, it is, what did I say it was? It was a Sabbath Sanctum.
Yeah, right. Holy Saturday.
Yes, this is Sabbath Sanctum or something like that.
Do you think we can mispronounce it and just call it Holy Saturday, which it's kind of pokey bushes that we can use?
Hello.
We have an engineer coming in here.
Nah, he's not an engineer. I have never seen him with a train, and to the best of my knowledge, he doesn't have a train.
A train of thought.
Yeah. Okay.
He's an engineer of a train of thought.
Good response. I like that.
All right. We are the Personal Wealth Coach. I'll hand it back over for the rest of the disclosure here.
Personal Wealth Coach is not merely the name of two guys who show up. I don't think show up be the right word. Who sound up on the radio on Saturday mornings. It is also the name of an investment advisory firm that manages wealth for people of reasonable net worth in Salado, Texas, and is its prime regulator, with which it is registered.
Registered. Just working on the.
I'm trying not to say, not make any claims here. Is this the United States Securities and Exchange Commission?
Right.
Which neither approves nor disapproves.
They just register.
That actually, there's a reason we say SEC registered investment advisor, because we are registered with the SEC rather than with the states.
Although we're registered with them too, but not in the same way.
No, we notify the states, but we register with the SEC. The point is that if an investment advisor has more than $100 million under management, they register with the Securities and Exchange Commission. If they have less than $100 million under management, they register with the states. So it's kind of a nice way to know how much money they're managing. I'm not sure what that means, but it sounds good.
Or at least we think it does.
Well, this is Saturday, April 15th, which would normally be tax due day, except for the fact since it's a weekend, it's not tax due day.
And because the 17th this year in Washington, D.C., is the compensated Lincoln compensated a whole bunch of states for the freeing. It's the compensated Emancipation Day.
It is an official holiday?
Only for Washington, D.C. It's not an official holiday in any other place.
For the rest of it, it's uncompensated?
Well,
if you take the day off, you don't get compensated?
I don't think that has anything to do with what the holiday is.
Oh, okay.
I think compensation
is. So it's like Tuesday when taxes are due?
Yeah, Tuesday, the 18th.
Oh, that's a really interesting bit of trivia. We should move to Washington, D.C. and get an extra day off.
Well, you could not move to Washington, D.C. and get an extra day to file your taxes.
Oh, that's cool. Anyway,
I don't want to live in Washington, D.C.
If today is Saturday, April 15th, where you are, and you're welcome to give us a call at 254 is the area code. And then it's 773-1400 if you'd like to call in here to the Personal Wealth Coach radio program and ask any questions, make any comments about anything to do with the economy or investing. We don't do sports.
Well, not well anyway.
We
don't do sports well.
Right.
Right.
Well, we don't do sports is my
Well, we don't do sports well.
So, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index was down 1.21% this week. It's been down 3 weeks now. A little bit more each week, which is an interesting factor. It's an interesting reality that's come about. The top was back at the beginning of March.
Right.
And it's been slipping downhill since then.
Coincides very well with when people decided, that health care bill is probably not going to pass, which means the tax acts are probably going to be a while, and the regulatory reform might not be as wonderful. So you said it well in the newsletter. We're in wait-and-see mode. But that's what we were for a whole year last year for the elections. So it's not a comfortable position for almost anyone. If you're a Republican, you're frustrated. If you're a Democrat, you're frustrated. If you're in the middle, you're uncomfortable and frustrated.
Well, the good news is that over the last 3 years, and I realize for those of you who are looking at this politically, it's going to be very confusing to you. But over the last 3 years, the average annual return of the S&P 500 has been about 7.5% a year, which is really not bad.
Not bad at all.
And it's a wonderful thing to get. As a matter of fact, if you keep going back.
Can I throw in right here? Because you said something about politics right there. Let me throw in. You said it's going to be very confusing for those of you who think about it politically, because there's no real correlation. And people tend to put presidents' faces over market stuff, and they don't need to. They shouldn't. It's confusing because it doesn't make sense. So back to you.
There's another – and it took me quite a while to work this out, by the way. Working through figures and figures and figures and figures and then going back – and then getting it wrong the first time and then going back and doing it again. But over the last 30 years, after you subtract out – inflation, the average annual rate of return of the S&P 500 has been about 4.36, 4.5, something like that. And that is really not bad at all. That is one of those wonderful things that we don't really appreciate how amazing that is.
And people don't hear that number, and when they do hear the number, they think that's a small number. No, that's with inflation removed. It's really a good deal.
So the point is that there's just not anything else out there that's done that well. In other words, you could choose anything. Oh, okay, I'm going to invest in let me say, as an asset class. In other words,
as
you
a
said,
class,
okay,
right.
Let's invest in a whole bunch of raw land in a lot of diversified places, because some places it may shoot through the stratosphere and some places it's going to fall. And you hold it for that long and you will discover that your average annual rate of return on average, again, with all these pieces of land, is probably something pretty close to the rate of inflation.
Right. Plus you have to pay taxes on it when you sell it, unless you die, and then it's okay.
And the reason
I was going to throw in this one thing just to be balanced. That isn't to say you can't make a fortune in real estate or in gold or
in
a lot of the other things, but it has a different component to it. We've got clients that have been real estate developers, and they made a fortune developing real estate, but they didn't just buy real estate and expect to sell it without doing anything to it at a profit. That's speculation. That's hoping somebody is going to pay you more than you paid for it just because you waited. And sometimes that works, but most of the time, the times that works is because you have an inefficient market. The more people are in the market, the more efficient the market gets. So the broader the real estate investments, the broader the expanse, the more diversified you are, the more people are involved in the market, which means all the inefficiencies are gone. Now, in a local area, you can say, I love this community and I'm thinking that it's going to do well for the next fill in the blank number of years, and so I'm going to buy this property, and then when people come to do that, I'll sell it to them. And it works really well, unless you live in Bartlett. If you live in Salado, it works great at the moment. In Bartlett, it doesn't work very well right now, and it has a lot to do with things other than your opinion. Where are people going? Where are they going to stay? And you're turning this around to
A message.
Oh, we have a message.
No, that's okay. I just wanted you to see the message.
Okay.
The reason I brought that up is because we get a lot of questions about should I – and this is the perennial question. I think it has a lot to do with the advertisements. Should I invest in gold? And so if you are a recipient of our newsletter, you know that I spent probably a third of the letter discussing that issue. And I discussed it for really good reason. Had you bought there's a rule that we use, and it isn't like it's magical or something. It comes out of something called portfolio theory, which was developed by a guy named Harry Markowitz in 1952 and has worked better than anything else since. I mean, that in and of itself, matter of fact, it's the only, frankly, it is one of the very few, let's put it like this, investment theories that consistently has worked for that length of time. Now, there's a couple of other ways of tweaking it to make it work a little better, but it's still basically the same thing. And that is, if you look back 30 years at an asset class, a class of investments, not individual investments, but a class of investments, and you see what they've done over the last 30 years after you subtract out inflation, that's pretty much what they're likely to do over the next 30 years. Now, the problem is, of course, there's going to be ups and downs in a 30-year period, and those ups and downs are going to come at what appear to be pretty random times. So trying to make shorter-term forecasts is a little more challenging, but we tend to think we can do it, but that's it. Now,
well,
here's
we
the
all
point.
Think we can do it.
Well, we've been pretty successful so far, and so are the people who followed who's followed portfolio theory. They basically say if you put the right mix of asset classes together, you don't know which one of them is going to go up or down when. But if you put a mix of asset classes together that over the last 30 years, after inflation is taken out, has a certain return, there seems to be a pretty high probability that over the next 30 years it'll have that same return. So we can, you know, that that works better than anything else, but nobody knows the future. I mean, all bets are off if a major asteroid smacks into the United States. So here's the point. Gold, let's take a look and see what has gold done over the last 30 years once we subtract out inflation. And the answer is a little less than 1% a year.
Yep.
Now, there's a negative to that too, though.
There's a couple of negatives to that.
Once you it's actually 0.92% a year has been your average annual rate of return after you subtract out inflation. Now, if you go back in and say, how much risk did it take to do that, depending on your definition of risk, had you invested in 1987, you would have had to wait 22 years before you wouldn't have taken a loss, presuming there's no commissions on the sale of gold. So if you're willing to accept 22 years of non-return, of a negative return, to get a less than one, get about actually after taxes, about 0.42% a year return on your investment, then gold is historically a pretty good place to be.
Let me add something to this. We all hear about people making a lot of money in gold.
We do?
Yeah, I hear about it. It's on the radio. It's on the television. People talk about it. It's difficult to find someone that you know. That's not the case in a lot of other areas. You can find someone you know who has made a lot of money
in
real estate
or in
stocks,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or in a lot of other areas in business. It's really, really hard to find someone who's actually made money in gold, not that they have gold and it's appreciated in value, because there's a peculiar piece to owning gold. People that go out and they think, I'm going to buy this gold and it's going to be worth a lot in the future, it's a collector's mentality. It's very much like sports cards, baseball cards, or comic books. There are people that I know, that I grew up with, that still have their entire comic book collection, or their entire Pokemon collection, or their entire baseball card collection. And they say, I've done so well with this. It's worth so much. And my answer to that is, well, when are you going to sell it? Well, I'm not going to sell it. Well, then it really isn't worth anything. It's worth your sentimental value and nothing more, because it's not an investment. It's a collection. And people collect because they like it. And that's why collections become worth something, is because people don't like to give up their collections. It's very much like art in some ways. Unless you're dealing in art, you shouldn't expect to constantly make a profit. Unless you're dealing in gold.
Here's the key about any investment. You only make money when you sell it.
That's correct.
Now, I want next time you see a gold advertisement, I want you to think about something.
What are they doing?
Somebody else is trying to make money by selling it to you.
Right.
Because they think now is an appropriate time to sell gold.
No, they think now is an appropriate time for you to buy gold while they sell it.
Right. They they're spending a lot of money trying to sell their gold. And this is another thing about the sale of gold. If you look at the advertisements that come on network television and you realize how expensive a network ad is, I mean, megabucks.
Yeah.
You realize the transaction cost for them of selling gold.
Yeah, and I've got to throw this
very,
in
very
there.
High transaction cost, because you've got to find a buyer and who will buy it at the price you want to sell it.
I know someone who's made a lot of money in gold. I know someone
really?
Who's made a lot of money in gambling.
Well, who you know somebody? How much money did they make in gold?
They owned a pawn shop, and they never bought the gold to hold it. They bought it at dirt cheap prices from people that showed up with broken chains and so on, melted it down, and sold it to jewelers. And they made a lot of money doing it.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't buying it because it was an inflation hedge. They weren't buying it because they thought someday in the future it's going to be worth a lot of money, or it's going to have a big bull market or whatever. They bought it because there was an inefficiency in the market. There's a bunch of people out there that have broken jewelry, don't know what it's worth, and they're willing to take pennies on the dollar, and then they did the extra work of melting it down, re-refining it, and then taking it back to a jeweler. They added value to that situation. If you're not adding value, you shouldn't expect a profit.
There is an opportunity to make money without – well, it's adding value in a way. And the opportunity is when something has an intrinsic value.
Right.
And you know what it is.
An inefficient market
selling,
exists.
And it's selling for half of its intrinsic value.
Yeah.
For instance, following the savings and loan crisis, there are people that I know who made a great deal of money in real estate without doing any improvements in the real estate.
No, they just bought real estate that nobody wanted at the moment.
Right. There was a shortage of money. They went in and bought fourplexes or raw land even at prices that were astonishingly low, where they could afford to do it. Now, one of the big things, of course, they had to have is either a really good line of credit, access to a good line of credit.
Or a lot of cash on hand.
Or a lot of cash on hand. But they went in and made some serious big money in real estate. But here's the point. If you listen to the story of people who do that, and you listen very carefully, they will often comment about who they got the real estate from, who owned the real estate before it was foreclosed on or whatever. And this is a point. The other side lost more money in many cases
than was gained by the person that purchased it.
Than was gained by the person who purchased it. Yeah. So that's what we call a net zero or actually net negative transaction.
It's in effect, if you think of a poker table.
Right.
All the money you can win in any given hand of poker is sitting there on the table. There's not – that pot doesn't grow unless somebody adds money out of their pocket to it. Now, if you think of a traditional business, that's not the case. You take money, you invest in a machine, and your time goes into it to create a product, and somebody wants to buy that product. And this is that's the big if. That's the reason why a business would fail or be very successful. Is if someone is willing to pay for that product above what it costs to make the product. And that's what all good business is. Those people don't want to set up the manufacturing of that product, but they like the product, so they're willing to pay a premium. That's an added value. That's not the case in real estate most often. It's not the case in raw gold most often. You can the case in both.
Right.
If you're a jeweler or if you're a real estate developer, you can add value. It's the fact that you hold something and expect to sell it for more, that's not investment, that's speculation. And in many cases with gold, that speculation isn't real because they're not really buying it because they expect to sell it. They're buying it because they want to look at the price at some point in the future and say, I made a good decision.
And there's a good article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday that covered that very nicely. Academically, and what it pointed out is that there was a study apparently back in the early 2000s. I missed the study, but I saw the results from it. And the study, the paper that came out, said that having commodities in your portfolio stabilizes your portfolio but does not decrease its return, which is kind of like a magic elixir or something.
Oh, yeah. How do you normally stabilize it and not decrease the return?
So the issue is the holy grail of investing is find some way to get as good or better return and more stability. Because there's this law, if you will, that was developed by that guy named Harry Markowitz we were talking about, that says the higher your return, the higher the variance, the higher the up and downs you're going to get. And if you could find something that you could, a single element that you'd stick into a portfolio and decrease the ups and downs, and at the same time either maintain the same return or get a better return, you would, you know, the world would beat a path to your door, and pretty soon the effect would probably go away. But that's all beside the point. And apparently this study that came out in the early 2000s that said commodities both stabilize a portfolio and possibly increase its return. A commodity be something like gold, for example, or copper or something like that in the portfolio. And it turned out that academically the thing doesn't work. The study was very carefully researched by some academics, and they concluded that it was basically hogwash. That was exactly the word that was used in the article, by the way.
That's a different commodity.
Yes.
Hogwash.
It's a rare one today, though.
There are not a lot of hogs that need washing, but you don't want to drink it after it's been used for washing hogs.
And it's got poisons in it, too, so that, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency is going to get involved.
Right.
But the point is that gold is a commodity, and the issue of sticking gold in a portfolio, making it either have a better return or having or a stabilizing return on the portfolio is pretty well, no, it doesn't work that way. What it does do, and this is consistent over time, the way that gold improves a portfolio is it makes the person who is investing who wanted gold in their portfolio happier than if they didn't have the gold in the portfolio.
Yes.
Even if it goes down.
Well, you have that gold in there. Oh yes. Okay. How's it done? Not well at all. Oh, well, I feel better about my portfolio. Oh, I've got to throw this in here. This is a piece of useless trivia, but I get asked it occasionally. What does portfolio mean? Okay.
A folio is a book, and a port is either something you drink or a place where a ship docks.
Well, it is specifically a place where a ship docks. Port got its name as a wine from ships docking.
Oh.
Portfolio means that if you are a trading vessel and you show up at a dock, the tax collector shows up and says, let me see a list of all the stuff that you have to trade port.
Using that technical term.
Stuff. Right. Yeah, stuff. So you get out the folder, the folio.
With all the stuff in it.
With all the stuff in it. Listed. And that is your portfolio.
Oh, cool.
That's it.
So you have, but you have to be a trading vessel.
Right. Well, or either that or have tradable commodities or tradable investments.
Or a merchant vessel.
Right. So when someone says portfolio, minus the model headshots, because models have portfolios. So do you have a portfolio? Yeah, here's all my headshots. Well, those are actually tradable commodities.
And since head is capital.
Yeah. It means capital.
That's their capital.
By the way, head means capital.
Or capital means
to,
head.
Yeah. To decapitate is to remove the head. So,
yeah.
Headshots and capital.
So that is her portfolio.
This is my folder full of capital.
Anyways, really. When you say portfolio, what we mean is the bunch of investments that you have. And there's lots of way of describing it. Some people have lots of investments in one account, and some people have a very significant number of investments in many accounts. But when you put it all together, all the securities investments that you own, we call that a portfolio.
Now, there's a couple of things that aren't generally included in a portfolio, like the house you're living in. It's kind of like when you pull up to port in your nice trading vessel. And you get
you're
out your portfolio, the vessel's not being traded because that's what you live in and that's your business or whatever. So at some point you might sell the vessel, but then it becomes part of the portfolio. So keep that in mind when somebody tells you your house isn't an investment. That's not exactly true. It is an investment. It's just not one that you're willing to trade in any given moment. Unless somebody offers you something really nice for it, just like that trading vessel. So anyway, that was useless trivia that you may be able to call upon for no apparent reason at Easter dinner. Well, I know what portfolio means. And they would say, here, have an egg. Shut up.
But you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400 on this Sanctum Sanctorum, whatever it is.
No, it's not Sanctorum. I think that you just called it a holy bag.
Oh, something like that.
Yeah. I think it's considered Holy Saturday, but they call it something
Saturday.
Sabbath-related.
Yeah, I had the meaning a minute ago.
So anyway, holy is also something referring to one who has holes.
Well, so. It could be. But at any rate, that's the telephone number,
254-773-1400. Hopefully nobody's listening today. Hopefully people have better things to do than
listen to two
bald guys talk on a Saturday.
It could just be wandering around out there, and that could be the whole point in the whole thing. Okay, so...
Now, all I had to do was say, hopefully nobody's listening, and we got a call coming.
Call. So you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Okay, this is the famous Flying Fox.
Hello, sir.
I thought you'd need some help. I've been listening to your show. And
we need all the help we can get,
sir. That's never been a thing that we bragged about, but we definitely need help.
Well, you know, I spent my first few years working for a living in the office, and I found out at coffee breaks, you got a bunch of people there that have never been in business, and they know all about running a business.
Well, you just get them together and put them on the board of directors then.
Only if there's a water cooler in the director's room.
Okay.
But you understand the sarcasm there. The coffee breakers think they know about running business since they've never done it. Well, I was in business in Houston for a few years, electronic business, and I learned more about business in the first few weeks there than I ever learned at coffee breaks. But what I learned mostly was the lack of knowledge that customers have. Now, at one time there, I was selling VCRs when they first came out, and I was only trying to make about 10%. That's something else people don't understand, the percent that people make in business. I was trying to make percent, and I had one VCR that I was advertising for $5.99. Saw a customer there looking at it real close, and I asked him, can I help you? Well, he said, yeah, I was looking at this VCR. You know, guy down the road here, he's selling the same thing. He's selling them for $4.99, and you're wanting $5.99. I said, well, I knew that couldn't be true. But I said, well, why don't you go down there and buy one from him? He said, I would, but he's out of stock. I said, oh, I see. Well, see, when I'm out of stock, I sell them for $3.99. And he didn't understand. But you know, if people knew that, like Exxon, one time was advertised in the paper as one of the companies with vulgar profits, $107 billion, and in gross, that was their gross. Their profit was $7 billion, and the newspaper indicated that was vulgar profits, when IBM, whose gross was $55 million and their net was $10 million, was making more money by percentage than Exxon. And of course, what people didn't know, Exxon was paying dividends at 6%, even though they only made 7%. People don't realize how close some companies have to operate, very close to the margin of profit.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely true.
Absolutely true. We've got some commercials to play, and I've got an email to answer here on the air. Thank you, famous Flying Fox, for your help. Every time you call in, it's
a delight.
It's a delight.
Well, I just do it for my fan club. I'll see you later.
All right.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Let me hit this email before we go to break. Lynn Woolley, another famous personality.
Lynn Woolley.
Yeah. Emailed in about how it is quite possible to make a large amount of money in comic book collection. Only at the beginning of the email, he mentions that a collection is a collection. It's worth a lot of money. And this comes back to what I was saying about certain areas. Gold has at times been incredibly valuable, even recently. But people that owned gold during that time, unless they were a dealer, weren't selling it. They were buying more of it. And the same's true with most comic book collectors. And I say most very clearly here. It's quite possible if you understand the market, which is part of what his email is that you really have to understand the market. You have to understand what grading is and what key issues are. And the whole concept there, if you understand that and you're only collecting the comic books, then you have a great collection and it's a fantastic thing. And hopefully your heirs know the value of those collections, because otherwise they might sell them at a garage sale. If you are making a living in comic books, you can do that, and you can do it as an investment portfolio, but you have to do it by selling the comic books. And this is one of those things that's the most difficult when it comes to collectors, is they don't want to sell their collections. That's why they have them. It's part of the reason why those collections are valuable, is because no one wants to sell them once they have them. And they may sell you the things that they don't like, or the things that they, because of demand out there, either because there's too many of them that were produced, or it was a bad issue, or whatever. The reality is you can make a great deal of money doing it, and people have. He mentions the owner of the Orioles, which, isn't that a cookie? No, that's Oreo. That's the Orioles. That's a bird. He owns birds. If we said we were bad at sports, I think it's a basketball team.
It is?
I'm not sure. I have no idea. It's the Orioles. But he started his fortune with comic books. And it's a very reasonable approach. I remember as a teenager, I had a lot of friends that collected comic books, and they thought that I needed to get into the comic book collecting business being just buy them and hold them forever. And I wound up buying comic books and then selling them to my friends because they didn't even want to read the comic books. They had them wrapped in plastic with a firm backing and stuck in a box that is a specially made box for humidity and all that stuff.
It's an interesting thing about many alternative investments. Comic books would fall into the category
right,
of alternative.
Right. For a lot of people, it's an investment, but it's not one they ever want to sell.
It's only valuable as long as the consensus is they not be sold. As long as there's buyers who want to buy them but don't want to sell them.
Right.
Then the value, that's the true of any commodity that isn't used in production. For instance, there is a little bit of production use of gold, but mostly gold is just for collections.
And it's more so.
As long as you have the majority of people around the world believing that they should be buying gold and not selling it, then the value of gold will probably rise. But the moment we hit a situation like an economic downturn, as we saw in 2009, where people need to recover all that value that they have in the gold, the price will drop. And historically, when that type of thing has happened, it has often dropped precipitously.
What happens with comic books is you have these moves up and down in value depending on when big collections come to market. And that generally happens with the death of someone, because big collections don't generally just go to market. This is a really good way of looking at that. And Lynn, this is directly to you. If you are in that area where you're collecting things, whether it doesn't matter what it is, a baseball card or whatever, the most famous stories aren't the fish that got away. It isn't the I almost got this card. That's a good story, and they exist out there. I almost got the Babe Ruth card or whatever. The most famous stories are the heartbreaking stories of why someone had to sell and how it was a bad idea to sell at the time, and the whole concept of I wish I hadn't sold it then. I got this money and I really needed to sell it, but I shouldn't have because it became more valuable later. That's something synonymous with collections. People have the collections because they hate the thought of selling them.
You said we had to do commercials.
Yes, let's do that. So we'll be back on the other end of the commercials with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join us in here, we've got emails available, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And we're actually reading those emails during the program because we're either that bored or have too much free time. So 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other end with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. And at some point, we might want to actually talk about the economy. I don't know if we want to or not.
I think we've been talking about the economy somewhere, somehow.
There's a fascinating but common conundrum going on. I love that mixture. Doesn't it sound good? Fascinating but common conundrum. As this particular session in the economy begins to broil out to whatever direction it's going to go, or boil out as the case may be. And that is that both business and consumer confidence are about the highest they have been since 1999 or 2000. When everybody was just giddy with everything is going to get better forever and we're all going to be fabulously wealthy multi-gazillionaires or something to that effect. But unlike 1999 and 2000, consumers are not spending even as much as they make. Their savings rates are up, meaning they're just not spending money. Businesses are showing a very, very poor investment ratio. In other words, they're not going to the bank and saying, look, I think I can do a lot better or more efficient business if I buy this equipment or this new piece of property or this new building or all the things that businesses need to do to expand to make the economy grow fast. In order to do those things, they have to go to the bank and borrow some money, and they're not doing it, and they're not expanding. And so we're back in a really peculiar position, and that's fundamentally why you see the market sagging over the last couple of weeks. Is some of that euphoria that we got right after the election, when we thought we were going to have the Republicans are going to control the House and the Senate and the White House, and we're going to get a tax cut, we're going to get regulatory cut.
Right, all the things that have been big complaints, not just for the right wing, but for the center as well, for a long time, have been high taxes, high regulation. The healthcare needs to be fixed. There's problems with the Affordable Care Act, and there's some disappointment out there over the whole concept of it right now.
We're cruising along towards not being able to get any of that done, despite the fact the people who said previously they wanted to do it are in control. And that's causing a lot of confusion, to the point where, once again, both businesses and individuals are looking down the road and saying, what will the economy be like a year from now? What will the tax code be like a year from now? What will my health care cost a year from now?
Nobody knows.
Right, and there's no leadership. And the absence of leadership in that area, the absence of concrete guidance that can be trusted, disappeared when the Affordable Care Act blew up in the House of Representatives.
Right.
The confidence, even though the confidence is still there, people are still very hopeful something will happen.
They don't know when or what or how, and that unknowing, the market hates the unknown. I mean, we could just say people hate the unknown. It's the thing we're the most afraid of.
I think it's prejudicial.
It is. I mean, it's why people are afraid of the dark. We don't know what's in it. That's what we're doing in the market right now. What does the future hold on a whole series of areas that are really important to us, that if nobody has said we're going to make a change, we could just say it's going to be like it is today. But people are saying it's going to change, and they still want to do the change, but they're not really saying clearly when or how or what. And that's really scary and confusing.
I'm going to roll in here with an I told you so.
Okay.
Which is a little bit dangerous. But
Don't put your shoulder out of socket by patting yourself on the back.
It's not so much patting ourselves on the back. It's a matter of economics. Early on, when the promises were being made, both by the Trump administration and by particularly people in the House, Republicans in the House of Representatives, that said we're going to cut the corporate income tax rate to 20%. We're going to increase defense spending. And we're going to increase infrastructure spending. And we're going to do all this at the same time. You may recall, if you've listened to this program any length of time, the fact that we said that doesn't work because these are the same people who are saying we're going to shrink the deficit. So what we're going to do is spend more money, have less revenue, and get rid of our debt all at the same time. And that is the...
That would be nice. It'd be kind of like you being able to say, hey, honey, I just got a pay cut at work. We should put more on the credit cards because the credit cards are going to be paid off with the credit cards being paid off by themselves.
Let's go out and do a really expensive vacation and build on to the house. And
while we're cutting down on the credit card debt.
And cut our debt because I'm going to get a pay cut at work.
Well, that sounds nice. Well, the good news is that I'm not going to have to be at work as much.
Yeah,
but,
that's it.
You know, there's problems there. It's an issue of finance doesn't work that way. There's too many negatives on the adding together, so you wind up with a negative at the bottom.
There is a fundamental reality, and that is that in order to have the lower corporate tax rates, it would cause the corporations to bring all this money home and keep their money here and bring jobs back and do all these wonderful things and be competitive at the corporate tax level with Europe and Japan and every place else that we compete with, we have to raise personal taxes. Now, the plan was, in the House Representatives, a better way, to do it in a backdoor sort of way. If we put a 20%, it's not officially called a tariff, but if we tax, we put
border adjustment.
A border adjustment tax.
Border adjustment, would be meaning to move the border slightly, make it bigger or smaller. I don't know. But a border adjustment tax is, it comes in and we're going to tax it, but it's not a tariff. Well, that's
the problem is
the definition of a tariff.
If you consider the food and products you buy at the grocery store to be necessities, it effectively puts, and depends on which economist you're listening to, somewhere between a 10 and 20% tax on your grocery bill, on your gasoline. So basically it was the basic story, and we said this back then, and which is why I don't think we're going to see it happen. It amounts to we're going to cut corporate taxes from 35%, 39%?
39.
We're going to cut corporate taxes roughly in half. We're going to, by raising the revenue that the federal government gets from particularly lower income individuals.
Let me come at this from a different direction. Because people, a lot of our listeners are aware of the fair tax and the concept behind the fair tax as a sales tax instead of an income tax, and how long term it would have no impact on the prices of goods at the store. They wouldn't go up by the amount of the sales tax because the corporate taxes wouldn't be paid, it wouldn't be an income tax paid on it. So the idea of, for instance, if you're buying a dollar widget, and underneath that dollar widget, all the profits are taxed at 20%, and that widget no longer has the profits taxed, instead the sales price is taxed. Well, it should amount to the same price. It's not exactly correct, and there's some problems with that. I really like the idea of it, but the extrapolation's not so good. If we do a border adjustment tax, I'm going to use a specific item, avocado. So if you have an avocado, I like avocados. They're great for guacamole. They're great for all kinds of good things. So you get an avocado. Well, this time of year, we're going to start seeing some American avocados just for a little bit. But most of the year, those avocados come from Mexico or other places in South America. The profit margin on the corporations that are importing those avocados is relatively small. So say a 6% profit margin, which is probably higher than it was. So for every dollar you spend on an avocado, the corporation gets 6 cents as a profit. And that 6 cents is taxed. Well, if you get rid of that tax and instead just put a 20% border adjustment tax, you're now spending $1.20 for the same number of avocados, and the corporation's still only getting 6 cents. So there are some major problems with making it status quo, making it the same event from one moment to the next. The other question is, how does that border adjustment tax work? Because we've got lots of questions on who it's being applied to. Is it just countries that have a trade deficit with the United States, or where we have a trade deficit with them? If that's the case, then how do we define a trade deficit? And are we going to tax a corporation who's importing more stuff from the United States than they're exporting to the United States if their country that they are working in has a – you see where I'm going with this. It's way complex all of a sudden, way beyond the simplistic concept of, oh, we're just going to do a border adjustment tax and it'll take care of this whole thing and we can lower the taxes.
So
it's a complex item.
It boils down to the fact, and I'm – sad to say this because I really think there was a potential to do something. Don't expect much change.
Expect a lot of not change loudly.
And the thing that the not change problem is going to come to a head next month. And actually, at the end of this month is when this is April. I forgot that.
Yeah.
It's not March. Okay. At the end of April, the legislation funding the government expires, April 28th, to be exact. And at that point, new legislation needs to be in place to raise the debt ceiling and to authorize the government to spend more money. And there is a bit of a logjam right now. That's an understatement. There are the same people who have wanted historically to cut the deficit, still want to cut the deficit. But the rest of the Republican Party has promised increased defense spending and increase a lot of other spending at the same time. Increase infrastructure spending, increase defense spending, increase homeland security spending. $3 billion, I just saw the number, $3 billion for a border wall. I didn't know.
That's not enough for the border wall.
But they want to include in this budget that comes out before April 28th, $3 billion to get the border wall started. That won't get the job done, but it'll at least get the bidding done and the initial, maybe a survey or something.
That's an expensive survey.
Well, that's just – but that's just
– government budgets.
Yeah. The point is, watch this corner, because if everything comes off as dysfunctionally as it did for the healthcare issue, because of an absence of a clear plan and clear leadership, I hate to say this, but we're liable to see the markets react negatively. Does that mean you should get out of the market? Absolutely not.
No.
But we, as we've said in the past, the real reason the market should be up is because of underlying corporate earnings, which are going to be really impressive this quarter, I think. I think we're going to see double-digit earnings growth over last year at this time, not because of a change of leadership.
No.
But because the oil crisis is behind us.
Yeah, there's enough of the good news out there in the economy that's being overlaid with the political mumbo-jumbo riffraff screaming back and forth, because politics has a bigger microphone than the economy. And the economy's in good shape. Well, I mean, there are definitely exceptions. I think the bond market is, to say the least, frothy. It's got lots of bubbles, lots of little bubbles. And maybe a bigger bubble coming in the middle of it. There's more stuff to talk about that. But just be aware that the bond market it's been the place for stability for a long time, and people still think of it that way. And going forward, it may not be. But there are huge chunks of the economy that are just in great shape. If we had some form of future stability in how business will be run, what taxes might be, what all of that, then I think we would be in a lot better shape.
We're almost out of time for this hour. I just want to add something here. I'm going to say something a little bit political, and you may not like it, but the fact that the president, instead of looking hard at the fact that by the end of April, we're going to have a fiscal crisis where we need to be focused on finance and taxes, has pivoted back to health care, suggests to me that we're probably going to have a crisis towards the end of this month.
Yeah.
So just hang on, ride through it.
It's the same kind of crisis that we've had lots and lots and lots and lots of times in the past 10 years. And every time it seems like, oh, this is new, ride through it.
So just ride through it and recognize that the system seems to be working quite well despite all the noise.
And if you would like to contact us off the air, we'll be back next hour. But if you'd want to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting.
254-947-1111.
Or 1-800-914-PLAN. You can reach us by email, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Listen to podcasts, read our newsletter, read our philosophy. And hopefully you'll be fine with that. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Truth. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.